Good morning and happy May Day. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's program consolidates the merry month of May fore and aft, beginning with a hosanna to this most beloved month of humanity's earthly calendar, and climaxes with the tragedy of Vanport, Oregon, at the end of the month of May, 1 year. And I'd begin with May Day, something I wrote. A call for rebellion, a call for change, a call for help. May Day, the ancient celebration of spring, the festival of rebirth. May Day is celebrated all over the world in every culture and kitchen. For many, it is Labor Day in honor of the anonymous billions who break their backs or wear out their nerves for their daily bread. It is the symbol of seeding the earth in hope of a good harvest to ease the dreadful hunger that stalks the human race. May Day is also a day of revolution, a charge against history that demands sweeping changes among the world's societies. This claim usually originates from compassion and the perception that there is no excuse for anyone to go hungry, be without shelter, or denied adequate health and medical care. It is the demand for freedom and respect of all the world's people. The world situation perpetually eludes optimists and idealists. The balance of wealth and distribution of resources is dismally inequitable, which intensifies the disparity between rich and poor. Millions are out of work, their lives ruined by poverty. Millions more die from famine and epidemics. Oppression and tyranny infect the world's governments. World leaders move pitilessly against their own peoples and their neighbors. Police and soldiers shoot into crowds. Nuclear obliteration remains probable. The millennium is an X-ray of our history, which lies behind us like an immense junkyard that seems cluttered with artifacts of no use to us anymore. We try to escape history as if by accelerating past we are Teflon, but history brought us to where we are and made us who we are. A true calendar of the human experience would discard bipolar dogmata and account for at least 1,000 millennia in a straight line from cave and claw. We have built a global greenhouse and we dwell within. We have pummeled and plundered our home planet as if it offered an inexhaustible feast without charge or cleanup. But the consequences of our careless and excessive indulgence are converging approximate with our disregard and denial. Our probable proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or danger or combination of them, but because we seem helpless to undo the damage or change direction. Our paradox is that our bountiful civilization is based on processes that threaten to obliterate it. Yet, optimism persists, perhaps because in even the worst of times, our predecessors always raise a maypole for themselves and their children to dance around. Perhaps in especially the worst times, it is necessary to hope. And that is at least my annual May Day salute, which I wrote for my newspaper, now defunct, the North Coast Times Eagle. And now, something I also wrote for my newspaper, Vanport, the town nobody wanted. One of the world's worst examples of city planning was Vanport, Oregon, the city where Delta Park in Portland is now. When it was dramatically submerged like a latter-day Atlantis on Memorial Day in 1948, Vanport had a population of almost 20,000 persons, all of whom were made homeless by the rampaging Columbia and Willamette Rivers in less than an hour and a half. A faulty dike system was the cause of Vanport's death. The water poured through a break in an old railroad embankment, and for weeks, Vanport was at the bottom of a lake. The reason Vanport died is of vital importance to contemporary land use planning. What was Vanport? It was a war baby, born of necessity for housing some 40,000 workers for Henry J. Kaiser's shipyards in Portland and Vancouver. It was the second largest city in Oregon during World War II, and was once described by former Mayor Earl Riley as the largest housing project in the nation. Vanport was built in 1942 on marshy lowlands along the Columbia River, less than 2 miles from where the Columbia converges with the Willamette. Touted as the miracle city on the Columbia that Kaiser built, quote, unquote, Vanport was never more than a huge collection of cracker box houses strung together fast and cheap, according to one of its residents. But from its conception, Vanport was more than just a war baby. It was a bastard child. It had no mayor or city council, but was instead administered by the Portland Housing Authority. It had no local industry except for gas stations and grocery stores. It had a population of blue-collar workers, at least one-fourth of whom were blacks, recruited by Kaiser from southern states. After the war, Portland used Vanport as the dumping ground for its human waste, a former resident said. By the time the flood wiped us out, it was almost all low-cost housing for the poor. The City of Roses made no pretense of hiding its fears that Vanport was a slum in the making, a potential cesspool of crime, a debaser of real estate values, and a prospective leech on a tax roll, Walter Matilda wrote in the Oregon Journal a year after the flood. As the largest housing project in the nation, Vanport could become the biggest municipal headache of its time, Mayor Riley said in October 1945. Julia Rutila, who was fired from her job with the State Welfare Division for her investigative reporting of the flood, told Metropolis Magazine that after the war, quote, the power structures in Portland and Vancouver, Washington, wanted all the blacks to go back where they came from. Many of them did, Julia said, but at least one-fourth of Vanport's population at the time of the flood was black. The other largest single group was veterans who came to Vanport after the war and couldn't find jobs. Because of that situation, one-fourth of the city was on welfare. I think that because the majority of Vanport's population was poor, Ms. Rutila continued, black and white, whether on welfare or working at low-paying jobs, the housing authority just didn't care to meet its responsibilities to the people. Never has a city grown so big so fast, lived so short a life, and died so suddenly with so little loss of life, Leverett Richards wrote about Vanport in the Oregonian on the 20th anniversary of the Memorial Day flood. At least a score of Vanport's residents died in the flood. Thousands lost everything they owned. it would seem that the planners who would build a city in a swamp between two rivers would deem flood control as a first priority. All we had in Vanport was a makeshift leaky dike system and no little Dutch boy to plug it with his finger, a survivor said 25 years after the disaster. The dike that broke had been an old railroad embankment constructed of sand and soft earth that was never intended to resist the powerful lateral hydraulic pressure of a flood or protect a town, an editorial in the Portland Sun said 3 days after the dike burst. The Oregon media agonized over the Vanport disaster, but all it could do was raise questions for which there were obvious answers, and just as obvious, a desire to avoid them. Former Oregonian reporter Bob Clark, whose Vanport home was destroyed by the flood, posed one of the questions a month afterward. We have learned that the Columbia long had regarded those murky bottoms as her own property, he wrote. We have been told that she swept through from time to time when the Snake, Willamette, or other tributaries dumped too much water into her main channel. Did the men who laid out Vanport know that? Clark asked. Julia Rutila says they did. She told Metropolis magazine that several members of the Army Corps of Engineers had warned the housing authority before Vanport was built that the area was one of, quote, calculated risk, unquote. But I don't think they really cared, Julia said. Portland did not want the blacks, neither did Vancouver. That was one of the main reasons Vanport was built, and I seriously believe a reason the housing authority chose to go ahead and build the city in that area of calculated risk. And that was Julia Rutila. Hours before the floodwaters swept through the Smith Lake Dike, Army engineers and housing authority officials inspected the dike and reported in good shape. By that time, the housing authority had moved its records out of Vanport, and the supermarkets moved out their safes, Ms. Rutila said. All they left were the people. Residents had become increasingly worried when the rivers began rising before the fateful Memorial Day. Unseasonal runoff of late snow and several days of heavy rains had swollen the Columbia and Willamette rivers to levels not recorded since the 1894 flood. To counter growing demands for evacuation of Vanport from its residents, the housing authority responded with a handbill that was delivered from door to door proclaiming, "The dikes are safe at present. You will be warned if necessary. You will have time to leave. Don't get excited," quote, unquote. The executive board of the Vanport Tenants League filed suit against the housing authority a month after the flood. The case, which never reached the courts, demanded the housing authority be held legally responsible for not having evacuated the people of Vanport prior to the flood, not having provided an adequate warning system, and for having issued reassuring statements denying any immediate danger. Again, when people talk or write about Vanport, they only talk about the flood, a survivor said. They don't deal with the fact that thousands of us were homeless or were forced to live in trailers or in barracks on Swan Island for months afterward. The housing authority did nothing to find replacement housing. We had to find it for ourselves, which was almost impossible because of housing shortages and the fact most of us were financially wiped out by the flood. Ms. Rutila, who was a reporter for the Longshoreman Dispatcher since 1946, was fired from her job with the State Welfare Division because she wrote that the victims, quote, were left entirely to their own devices with no aid from public agencies, unquote. The Welfare Division had declared the flood was a natural disaster and that the refugees were not entitled to relief, Ms. Rutila told Metropolis magazine. The Red Cross took the same position. Churches and schools threw open their doors, and several people took some of the victims into their homes, but there were thousands. Ms. Rutila said she and an Associated Press reporter went to the director of the Housing Authority after the flood and suggested that vacant hotel and motel rooms in Portland be used to temporarily house the Vanport refugees. He told us he couldn't do it because the rooms were reserved for Rose Festival visitors, she said. The Corps of Engineers said there will never be another flood like the Memorial Day flood of 1948. They say the 14 major dams on the Columbia River and its major tributaries will resist another flood of Vanport proportion. As for Vanport's graveyard, it was designated for recreational land use because no one wanted to live there anymore. The destruction of the Vanport houses was long overdue, Dr. Richard M. Steiner, who was pastor of Portland's First Unitarian Church at the time of the flood, told his congregation and the Oregon Journal a month afterward. The tragedy lies in the destruction of lives and personal property, Dr. Steiner said. A different housing authority, more concerned for the people and less concerned for real estate values, would have long since created permanent housing for low-income groups in our city. Many, many years have passed, and the city of Portland still has not met that responsibility. And that was Vanport, the town nobody wanted, which I wrote for Metropolis magazine. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. A 1951 recording by the late, great Margaret Mead for a radio show I think was broadcast by CBS at the time, This I Believe, and which later was an NPR rebroadcast. She said that a person from New Guinea has as much brain capacity to attend Harvard as someone from Boston's Beacon Hill. Yet all persons become distinctly part of their home culture, whether New Guinea or Beacon Hill, which entails the necessity that distinct and alien cultures must be studied and accepted by all other cultures. Ms. Mead believed that humanity has barely touched its potential and that humans are neither good or evil, but contain qualities and quantities of both, which are determined by culture and family. It is intrinsic in every human to love and trust, or to fear, hate, and conform, she said. Humans are builders, thinkers, seers, and prophets, creators of tools, art, and philosophy, she said, and that a humble but persistent study of human behavior is essential, and that humanity must realize the task of creating one world in order to keep the future safe, yet act to keep the future free. And that was Margaret Mead. I had considered recording today's program with a litany of Impeach Trump as not only its theme, but its entire requiem. Yet, as a call of distress, Mayday aptly stresses the calamity of Trump.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.